The Secret of Divine Civilization, Cassette Number 1, Side 2, continuing from page 21.
Again, there are those famed and accomplished men of learning, possessed of praiseworthy qualities and vast erudition, who lay hold on the strong handle of the fear of God and keep to the ways of salvation. In the mirror of their minds, the forms of transcendent realities are reflected, and the lamp of their inner vision derives its light from the sun of universal knowledge. They are busy by night and by day with meticulous research into such sciences as are profitable to mankind, and they devote themselves to the training of students of capacity. It is certain that to their discerning taste, the proffered treasures of kings would not compare with a single drop of the waters of knowledge, and mountains of gold and silver could not outweigh the successful solution of a difficult problem. To them, the delights that lie outside their work are only toys for children, and the cumbersome load of unnecessary possessions is only good for the ignorant and base. Content, like the birds, they give thanks for a handful of seeds, and the song of their wisdom dazzles the minds of the world's most wise. Again, there are sagacious leaders among the people and influential personalities throughout the country who constitute the pillars of state. Their rank and station and success depend on their being the well-wishers of the people and in their seeking out such means as will improve the nation and will increase the wealth and comfort of the citizens. Observe the case when an individual is an eminent person in his country, zealous, wise, pure-hearted, known for his innate capacity, intelligence, natural perspicacity, and is also an important member of the state. What for such an individual can be regarded as honor, abiding happiness, rank and station, whether in the here or the hereafter? Is it a diligent attention to truth and righteousness? Is it dedication and resolve and devotion to the good pleasure of God? Is it the desire to attract the favorable consideration of the ruler and to merit the approval of the people? Or would it rather consist in this, that for the sake of indulging in feasts and dissipations by night, he should undermine his country and break the hearts of his people by day, causing his God to reject him and his sovereign to cast him out, and his people to defame him and hold him in deserved contempt? By God, the moldering bones in the graveyard are better than such as these. Of what value are they, who have never tasted the heavenly food of truly human qualities and never drunk of the crystalline waters of those bounties which belong to the realm of man? It is unquestionable that the object in establishing parliaments is to bring about justice and righteousness. But everything hinges on the efforts of the elected representatives. If their intention is sincere, desirable results and unforeseen improvements will be forthcoming. If not, it is certain that the whole thing will be meaningless. The country will come to a standstill, and public affairs will continuously deteriorate. I see a thousand builders unequal to one subverter. What then of the one builder who is followed by a thousand subverters? The purpose of the foregoing statements is to demonstrate at least this, that the happiness and greatness, the rank and station, the pleasure and peace of an individual have never consisted in his personal wealth, but rather in his excellent character, his high resolve, the breadth of his learning, and his ability to solve difficult problems. How well has it been said, "On my back is a garment which, were it sold for a penny, that penny would be worth far more. Yet within the garment is a soul, which, if you weighed it against all the souls in the world, would prove greater and nobler." In the present writer's view, it would be preferable if the election of non-permanent members of consultative assemblies in sovereign states should be dependent on the will and choice of the people, for elected representatives will on this account be somewhat inclined to exercise justice, lest their reputation suffer and they fall into disfavor with the public. It should not be imagined that the writer's earlier remarks constitute a denunciation of wealth or a commendation of poverty. Wealth is praiseworthy in the highest degree if it is acquired by an individual's own efforts and the grace of God in commerce, agriculture, art, and industry, and if it be expended for philanthropic purposes. Above all, if a judicious and resourceful individual should initiate measures which would universally enrich the masses of the people, there could be no undertaking greater than this, and it would rank in the sight of God as the supreme achievement, for such a benefactor would supply the needs and ensure the comfort and well-being of a great multitude. Wealth is most commendable, provided the entire population is wealthy. If, however, a few have inordinate riches, while the rest are impoverished, and no fruit or benefit accrues from that wealth, then it is only a liability to its possessor. If, on the other hand, it is expended for the promotion of knowledge, the founding of elementary and other schools, the encouragement of art and industry, the training of orphans and the poor, in brief, if it is dedicated to the welfare of society, its possessor will stand out before God and man as the most excellent of all who live on earth, and will be accounted as one of the people of paradise. As to those who maintain that the inauguration of reforms and the setting up of powerful institutions would in reality be at variance with the good pleasure of God, and would contravene the laws of the divine lawgiver, and run counter to basic religious principles and to the ways of the prophet, let them consider how this could be the case. Would such reforms contravene the religious law, because they would be acquired from foreigners, and would therefore cause us to be as they are, since he who imitates a people is one of them? In the first place, these matters relate to the temporal and material apparatus of civilization, the implements of science, the adjuncts of progress in the professions and the arts, and the orderly conduct of government. They have nothing whatsoever to do with the problems of the spirit and the complex realities of religious doctrine. If it be objected that even where material affairs are concerned, foreign importations are inadmissible, such an argument would only establish the ignorance and absurdity of its proponents. Have they forgotten the celebrated hadith, that is, holy tradition, "Seek after knowledge even unto China"? It is certain that the people of China are, in the sight of God, among the most rejected of men, because they worship idols and are unmindful of the omniscient Lord. The Europeans are at least peoples of the book and believers in God, and specifically referred to in the sacred verse, "Thou shalt certainly find those to be nearest in affection to the believers who say, 'We are Christians.'" It is therefore quite permissible, and indeed more appropriate, to acquire knowledge from Christian countries. How could seeking after knowledge among the heathen be acceptable to God, and seeking it among the people of the book be repugnant to him? Furthermore, in the battle of the Confederates, Abu Sufyan enlisted the aid of Bani Kinane, the Bani Qata, and the Jewish Bani Quraizi, and rose up with all the tribes of the Quraysh to put out the divine light that flamed in the lamp of Yathrib, Medina. In those days, the great winds of trials and tribulations were blowing from every direction, as it is written, "Do men think, when they say, 'We believe,' they shall be let alone and not be put to proof?" The believers were few, and the enemy attacking in force, seeking to blot out the new risen Son of Truth with the dust of oppression and tyranny. Then Salman, the Persian, came into the presence of the prophet, the dawning point of revelation, the focus of the endless splendors of grace. And he said that in Persia, to protect themselves from an encroaching host, they would dig a moat or trench about their lands, and that this had proved a highly efficient safeguard against surprise attacks. Did that wellspring of universal wisdom, that mine of divine knowledge, say in reply that this was a custom current among idolatrous, fire-worshipping Magians, and could therefore hardly be adopted by monotheists? Or did he rather immediately direct his followers to set about digging a trench? He, even in his own blessed person, took hold of the tools and went to work beside them. It is, moreover, a matter of record in the books of the various Islamic schools and the writings of leading divines and historians that after the light of the world had risen over Hijaz, flooding all mankind with its brilliance and creating through the revelation of a new divine law, new principles and institutions, a fundamental change throughout the world, holy laws were revealed which in some cases conformed to the practices of the days of ignorance. Among these, Muhammad respected the months of religious truce, retained the prohibition of swine's flesh, continued the use of the lunar calendar and the names of the months, and so on. There is a considerable number of such laws specifically enumerated in the texts. The people of the days of ignorance engaged in many practices which the law of Islam later confirmed. They would not take in marriage both a mother and her daughter, and the most shameful of acts in their view was to marry two sisters. They would stigmatize a man marrying the wife of his father, derisively calling him his father's competitor. It was their custom to go on pilgrimage to the house at Mecca, where they would perform the ceremonies of visitation, putting on the pilgrim's dress, practicing the circumambulation, running between the hills, pausing at all the stopping places, and casting the stones. It was furthermore their wont to intercalate 1 month in every 3-year period, to perform ablutions after intercourse, to rinse out the mouth and snuff up water through the nostrils, to part the hair, to use the toothstick, pair the nails, and pluck the armpits. They would, likewise, cut off the right hand of a thief. Can one, God forbid, assume that because some of the divine laws resemble the practices of the days of ignorance, the customs of a people abhorred by all the nations, it follows that there is a defect in these laws? Or can one, God forbid, imagine that the omnipotent Lord was moved to comply with the opinions of the heathen? The divine wisdom takes many forms. Would it have been impossible for Muhammad to reveal a law which bore no resemblance whatever to any practice current in the days of ignorance? Rather, the purpose of his consummate wisdom was to free the people from the chains of fanaticism which had bound them hand and foot, and to forestall those very objections which today confuse the mind and trouble the conscience of the simple and helpless. Some who are not sufficiently informed as to the meaning of the divine texts and the contents of traditional and written history will aver that these customs of the days of ignorance were laws which had come down from His Holiness Abraham and had been retained by the idolaters. In this connection, they will cite the Quranic verse, "Follow the religion of Abraham, be sound in faith." Nevertheless, it is a fact attested by the writings of all the Islamic schools that the months of truce, the lunar calendar, and the cutting off of the right hand as punishment for theft formed no part of Abraham's law. In any case, the Pentateuch is extant and available today and contains the laws of Abraham. Let them refer to it. They will then, of course, insist that the Torah has been tampered with, and in proof will quote the Quranic verse. They pervert the text of the Word of God. It is, however, known where such distortion has occurred and is a matter of record in critical texts and commentaries. Were we to develop the subject beyond this brief reference, we would have to abandon our present purpose. According to some accounts, mankind has been directed to borrow various good qualities and ways from wild animals and to learn a lesson from these. Since it is permissible to imitate virtues of dumb animals, it is certainly far more so to borrow material sciences and techniques from foreign peoples, who at least belong to the human race and are distinguished by judgment and the power of speech. And if it be contended that such praiseworthy qualities are inborn in animals, by what proof can they claim that these essential principles of civilization, this knowledge and these sciences current among other peoples, are not inborn? Is there any creator save God? Say, praised be God. The most learned and accomplished divines, the most distinguished scholars, have diligently studied those branches of knowledge, the root and origin of which were the Greek philosophers, such as Aristotle and the rest, and have regarded the acquisition from the Greek texts of sciences such as medicine and branches of mathematics, including algebra and arithmetic, as a most valuable achievement. Every one of the eminent divines both studies and teaches the science of logic, although they consider its founder to have been a Sabian. Most of them have insisted that if a scholar has thoroughly mastered a variety of sciences, but is not well grounded in logic, his opinions, deductions, and conclusions cannot safely be relied upon. It has now been clearly and irrefutably shown that the importation from foreign countries of the principles and procedures of civilization and the acquisition from them of sciences and techniques, in brief, of whatsoever will contribute to the general good, is entirely permissible. This has been done to focus public attention on a matter of such universal advantage so that the people may arise with all their energies to further it, until, God helping them, this sacred land may within a brief period become the first of nations. O you who are wise, consider this carefully. Can an ordinary gun compare with a Martini Henry rifle or a Krupp gun? If anyone should maintain that our old-time firearms are good enough for us, and that it is useless to import weapons which have been invented abroad, would even a child listen to him? Or should anyone say, we have always transported merchandise from one country to another on the backs of animals? Why do we need steam engines? Why should we try to ape other peoples? Could any intelligent person tolerate such a statement? No, by the one God, unless he should, because of some hidden design or animosity, refuse to accept the obvious. Foreign nations, in spite of their having achieved the greatest expertness in science, industry, and the arts, do not hesitate to borrow ideas from one another. How can Persia, a country in the direst need, be allowed to lag behind, neglected, abandoned? Those eminent divines and men of learning who walk the straight pathway and are versed in the secrets of divine wisdom and informed of the inner realities of the sacred books, who wear in their hearts the jewel of the fear of God, and whose luminous faces shine with the lights of salvation, these are alert to the present need, and they understand the requirements of modern times, and certainly devote all their energies toward encouraging the advancement of learning and civilization. Are they equal, those who know and those who do not know? Or is the darkness equal with the light? The spiritually learned are lamps of guidance among the nations, the stars of good fortune shining from the horizons of humankind. They are fountains of life for such as lie in the depths of ignorance and unawareness, and clear springs of perfection for those who thirst and wander in the wasteland of their defects and errors. They are the dawning places of the emblems of divine unity and initiates in the mysteries of the glorious Koran. They are skilled physicians for the ailing body of the world. They are the sure antidote to the poison that has corrupted human society. It is they who are the strong citadel guarding humanity in the impregnable sanctuary for the sorely distressed, the anxious and tormented, victims of ignorance. Knowledge is a light which God casteth into the heart of whomsoever he willeth. For everything, however, God has created a sign and symbol, and established standards and tests by which it may be known. The spiritually learned must be characterized by both inward and outward perfection. They must possess a good character, an enlightened nature, a pure intent, as well as intellectual power, brilliance and discernment, intuition, discretion and foresight, temperance, reverence, and a heartfelt fear of God. For an unlit candle, however great in diameter and tall, is no better than a barren palm tree or a pile of dead wood. The flower-faced may sulk or play the flirt. The cruel fair may bridle and coquet. But coyness in the ugly is ill met, and pain in a blind eye's a double hurt. An authoritative tradition states, as for him who is one of the learned, he must guard himself, defend his faith, oppose his passions, and obey the commandments of his Lord. It is then the duty of the people to pattern themselves after him. Since these illustrious and holy words embody all the conditions of learning, a brief commentary on their meaning is appropriate. Whoever is lacking in these divine qualifications and does not demonstrate these inescapable requirements in his own life should not be referred to as learned and is not worthy to serve as a model for the believers. The first of these requirements is to guard one's own self. It is obvious that this does not refer to protecting oneself from calamities and material tests, for the prophets and saints were, each and every one, subjected to the bitterest afflictions that the world has to offer, and were targets for all the cruelties and aggressions of mankind. They sacrificed their lives for the welfare of the people, and with all their hearts they hastened to the place of their martyrdom. And with their inward and outward perfections they arrayed humanity in new garments of excellent qualities, both acquired and inborn. The primary meaning of this guarding of oneself is to acquire the attributes of spiritual and material perfection. The first attribute of perfection is learning and the cultural attainments of the mind, and this eminent station is achieved when the individual combines in himself a thorough knowledge of those complex and transcendental realities pertaining to God, of the fundamental truths of the Quranic political and religious law, of the contents of the sacred scriptures of other faiths, and of those regulations and procedures which would contribute to the progress and civilization of this distinguished country. He should, in addition, be informed as to the laws and principles, the customs, conditions and manners, and the material and moral virtues characterizing the statecraft of other nations, and should be well versed in all the useful branches of learning of the day, and study the historical records of bygone governments and peoples. For if a learned individual has no knowledge of the sacred scriptures and the entire field of divine and natural science, of religious jurisprudence, and the arts of government, and the varied learning of the time and the great events of history, he might prove unequal to an emergency, and this is inconsistent with the necessary qualification of comprehensive knowledge. If, for example, a spiritually learned Muslim is conducting a debate with a Christian and he knows nothing of the glorious melodies of the gospel, he will, no matter how much he imparts of the Quran and its truths, be unable to convince the Christian, and his words will fall on deaf ears. Should, however, the Christian observe that the Muslim is better versed in the fundamentals of Christianity than the Christian priests themselves, and understands the purport of the scriptures even better than they, he will gladly accept the Muslim's arguments, and he would indeed have no other recourse. When the chief of the exiles, the Resh Galuta, the ruler of the Jewish exiles in Babylon, came into the presence of that luminary of divine wisdom, of salvation and certitude, the Imam Ridda, had the Imam, that mine of knowledge, failed in the course of their interview to base his arguments on authority appropriate and familiar to the exile ark, the latter would never have acknowledged the greatness of his holiness. The state is, moreover, based upon two potent forces, the legislative and the executive. The focal center of the executive power is the government, while that of the legislative is the learned. And if this latter great support and pillar should prove defective, how is it conceivable that the state should stand? In view of the fact that at the present time such fully developed and comprehensively learned individuals are hard to come by, and the government and people are in dire need of order and direction, it is essential to establish a body of scholars, the various groups of whose membership would each be expert in one of the aforementioned branches of knowledge. This body should with the greatest energy and vigor deliberate as to all present and future requirements, and bring about equilibrium and order. Up to now, the religious law has not been given a decisive role in our courts, because each of the ulama has been handing down decrees as he saw fit, based on his arbitrary interpretation and personal opinion. For example, two men will go to law, and one of the ulama will find for the plaintiff and another for the defendant. It may even happen that in one and the same case, two conflicting decisions will be handed down by the same mujtahid, on the grounds that he was first inspired in one direction and then in the other. There can be no doubt that this state of affairs has confused every important issue and must jeopardize the very foundations of society. For neither the plaintiff nor the defendant ever loses hope of eventual success, and each in turn will waste his life in the attempt to secure a later verdict which would reverse the previous one. Their entire time is thus given over to litigation, with the result that their life, instead of being devoted to beneficial undertakings and necessary personal affairs, is completely involved with the dispute. Indeed, these two litigants might just as well be dead, for they conserve their government and community not a particle. If, however, a definite and final verdict were forthcoming, the duly convicted party would perforce give up all hope of reopening the case, and would then be relieved on that score, and would go back to looking after his own concerns and those of others. Since the primary means for securing the peace and tranquility of the people, and the most effective agency for the advancement of high and low alike, is this all-important matter, it is incumbent on those learned members of the great consultative assembly who are thoroughly versed in the divine law to evolve a single, direct, and definite procedure for the settlement of litigations. This instrument should then be published throughout the country by order of the king, and its provisions should be strictly adhered to. This all-important question requires the most urgent attention. The second attribute of perfection is justice and impartiality. This means to have no regard for one's own personal benefits and selfish advantages, and to carry out the laws of God without the slightest concern for anything else. It means to see oneself as only one of the servants of God, the all-possessing, and, except for aspiring to spiritual distinction, never attempting to be singled out from the others. It means to consider the welfare of the community as one's own. It means, in brief, to regard humanity as a single individual, and one's own self as a member of that corporeal form, and to know of a certainty that if pain or injury afflicts any member of that body, it must inevitably result in suffering for all the rest. The third requirement of perfection is to arise with complete sincerity and purity of purpose, to educate the masses, to exert the utmost effort to instruct them in the various branches of learning and useful sciences, to encourage the development of modern progress, to widen the scope of commerce, industry, and the arts, to further such measures as will increase the people's wealth. For the mass of the population is uninformed as to these vital agencies, which would constitute an immediate remedy for society's chronic ills. It is essential that scholars and the spiritually learned should undertake in all sincerity and purity of intent, and for the sake of God alone, to counsel and exhort the masses and clarify their vision with that collyrium which is knowledge. For today the people, out of the depths of their superstition, imagine that any individual who believes in God and his signs and in the prophets and divine revelations and laws and is a devout and God-fearing person, must of necessity remain idle and spend his days in sloth, so as to be considered in the sight of God as one who has forsaken the world and its vanities, set his heart on the life to come, and isolated himself from human beings in order to draw nearer to God. Since this theme will be developed elsewhere in the present text, we shall leave it for the moment. Other attributes of perfection are to fear God, to love God by loving his servants, to exercise mildness and forbearance and calm, to be sincere, amenable, clement, and compassionate, to have resolution and courage, trustworthiness and energy, to strive and struggle, to be generous, loyal, without malice, to have zeal and a sense of honor, to be high-minded and magnanimous, and to have regard for the rights of others. Whoever is lacking in these excellent human qualities is defective. If we were to explain the inner meanings of each one of these attributes, the poem would take up 70 mons of paper. The second of these spiritual standards, which apply to the possessor of knowledge, is that he should be the defender of his faith. It is obvious that these holy words do not refer exclusively to searching out the implications of the law, observing the forms of worship, avoiding greater and lesser sins, practicing the religious ordinances, and by all these methods protecting the faith. They mean rather that the whole population should be protected in every way, that every effort should be exerted to adopt a combination of all possible measures to raise up the Word of God, increase the number of believers, promote the faith of God, and exalt it and make it victorious over other religions. If, indeed, the Muslim religious authorities had persevered along these lines as they ought to have done, by now every nation on earth would have been gathered into the shelter of the unity of God and the bright fire of that he may make it victorious over every other religion, would have flamed out like the sun in the midmost heart of the world. 15 centuries after Christ, Luther, who was originally one of the 12 members of a Catholic religious body at the center of the papal government, and later on initiated the Protestant religious belief, opposed the Pope on certain points of doctrine, such as the prohibition of monastic marriage, the revering and bowing down before images of the apostles and Christian leaders of the past, and various other religious practices and ceremonies which were accretional to the ordinances of the gospel. Although at that period the power of the Pope was so great and he was regarded with such awe that the kings of Europe shook and trembled before him, and he held control of all Europe's major concerns in the grasp of his might, nevertheless, because Luther's position as regards the freedom of religious leaders to marry, the abstention from worshiping and making prostrations before images and representations hung in the churches, and the abrogation of ceremonials which had been added on to the gospel, was demonstrably correct, and because the proper means were adopted for the promulgation of his views, within these last 400 and some years, the majority of the population of America, 4/5 of Germany and England, and a large percentage of Austrians, in sum, about 125 million people drawn from other Christian denominations, have entered the Protestant Church. The leaders of this religion are still making every effort to promote it, and today on the east coast of Africa, ostensibly to emancipate the Sudanese and various Negro peoples, they have established schools and colleges and are training and civilizing completely savage African tribes, while their true and primary purpose is to convert some of the Muslim Negro tribes to Protestantism. Every community is toiling for the advancement of its people, and we, the Muslims, sleep on. Although it was not clear what purpose impelled this man or where he was tending, see how the zealous efforts of Protestant leaders have spread his doctrines far and wide. Now, if the illustrious people of the one true God, the recipients of his confirmations, the objects of his divine assistance, should put forth all their strength and with complete dedication, relying upon God and turning aside from all else but him, should adopt procedures for spreading the faith and should bend all their efforts to this end, it is certain that his divine light would envelop the whole earth. A few, who are unaware of the reality below the surface of events, who cannot feel the pulse of the world under their fingers, who do not know what a massive dose of truth must be administered to heal this chronic old disease of falsehood, believe that the faith can only be spread by the sword and bolster their opinion with the tradition. I am a prophet by the sword. If, however, they would carefully examine this question, they would see that in this day and age the sword is not a suitable means for promulgating the faith, for it would only fill people's hearts with revulsion and terror. According to the divine law of Muhammad, it is not permissible to compel the people of the book to acknowledge and accept the faith. While it is a sacred obligation devolving on every conscientious believer in the unity of God to guide mankind to the truth, the traditions, "I am a prophet by the sword," and "I am commanded to threaten the lives of the people until they say there is none other God but God," referred to the idolaters of the days of ignorance, who in their blindness and bestiality had sunk below the level of human beings. A faith born of sword thrusts could hardly be relied on, and would for any trifling cause revert to error and unbelief. After the ascension of Muhammad and his passing to the seat of truth in the presence of the potent king, the tribes around Medina apostatized from their faith, turning back to the idolatry of pagan times. Remember when the holy breaths of the Spirit of God, Jesus, were shedding their sweetness over Palestine and Galilee, over the shores of Jordan and the regions around Jerusalem, and the wondrous melodies of the gospel were sounding in the ears of the spiritually illumined, all the peoples of Asia and Europe, of Africa and America, of Oceania, which comprises the islands and archipelagos of the Pacific and Indian Oceans, were fire worshippers and pagans, ignorant of the divine voice that spoke out on the Day of the Covenant. Alone the Jews believed in the divinity and oneness of God. Following the declaration of Jesus, the pure and reviving breath of his mouth conferred eternal life on the inhabitants of those regions for a period of 3 years. And through divine revelation, the law of Christ, at that time the vital remedy for the ailing body of the world, was established. In the days of Jesus, only a few individuals turned their faces toward God. In fact, only the 12 disciples and a few women truly became believers, and one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, apostatized from his faith, leaving 11. After the ascension of Jesus to the realm of glory, These few souls stood up with their spiritual qualities and with deeds that were pure and holy, and they arose by the power of God and the life-giving breath of the Messiah to save all the peoples of the earth. Then all the idolatrous nations, as well as the Jews, rose up in their might to kill the divine fire that had been lit in the lamp of Jerusalem. Fain would they put out God's light with their mouths, but God hath willed to perfect his light, albeit the infidels abhor it. Under the fiercest tortures they did every one of these holy souls to death. With butcher's cleavers they chopped the pure and undefiled bodies of some of them to pieces and burned them in furnaces. And they stretched some of the followers on the rack and then buried them alive. In spite of this agonizing requital, the Christians continued to teach the cause of God, and they never drew a sword from its scabbard or even so much as grazed a cheek. Then in the end, the faith of Christ encompassed the whole earth, so that in Europe and America no traces of other religions were left, and today in Asia and Africa and Oceania, large masses of people are living within the sanctuary of the four Gospels. It has now, by the above irrefutable proofs, been fully established that the faith of God must be propagated through human perfection, through qualities that are excellent and pleasing, and spiritual behavior. If a soul of his own accord advances toward God, he will be accepted at the threshold of oneness, for such a one is free of personal consideration, of greed and selfish interests, and he has taken refuge within the sheltering protection of his Lord. He will become known among men as trustworthy and truthful, temperate and scrupulous, high-minded and loyal, incorruptible and God-fearing. In this way, the primary purpose in revealing the divine law, which is to bring about happiness in the afterlife and civilization and the refinement of character in this, will be realized. As for the sword, it will only produce a man who is outwardly a believer and inwardly a traitor and apostate. We shall here relate a story that will serve as an example to all. The Arabian Chronicles tell how, at a time prior to the advent of Muhammad, Nu'man, son of Mundir, the Lakhmite, an Arab king in the days of ignorance, whose seat of government was the city of Hira, had one day returned so often to his wine cup that his mind clouded over and his reason deserted him. In this drunken and insensible condition, he gave orders that his two boon companions, his close and much-loved friends, Khalid, son of Mudalil, and Amr, son of Masud Kalde, should be put to death. When he wakened after his carousal, he inquired for the two friends and was given the grievous news. He was sick at heart, and because of his intense love and longing for them, he built two splendid monuments over their two graves, and he named these the Smeared with Blood. Then he set apart 2 days out of the year in memory of the two companions, and he called one of them the Day of Evil and one the Day of Grace. Every year on these two appointed days he would issue forth with pomp and circumstance and sit between the monuments. If, on the day of evil, his eye fell on any soul, that person would be put to death. But on the day of grace, whoever passed would be overwhelmed with gifts and benefits. Such was his rule, sealed with a mighty oath, and always rigidly observed. One day the king mounted his horse, that was called Mahmud, and rode out into the plains to hunt. Suddenly, in the distance, he caught sight of a wild donkey. Nu'man urged on his horse to overtake it, and galloped away at such speed that he was cut off from his retinue. As night approached, the king was hopelessly lost. Then he made out a tent far off in the desert, and he turned his horse and headed toward it. When he reached the entrance of a tent, he asked, "Will you receive a guest?" The owner, who was Hanzalah, son of Abi Gaphraetai, replied, "Yea." He came forward and helped Numan to dismount. Then he went to his wife and told her, "There are clear signs of greatness in the bearing of this person. Do your best to show him hospitality and make ready a feast." His wife said, "We have a ewe, sacrifice it, and I have saved a little flour against such a day." Hanzalah first milked the ewe and carried a bowl of milk to Numan. Then he slaughtered her and prepared a meal. And what with his friendliness and loving kindness, Numan spent that night in peace and comfort. When dawn came, Numan made ready to leave, and he said to Hanzalah, "You have shown me the utmost generosity, receiving and feasting me. I am Numan, son of Mundir, and I shall eagerly await your arrival at my court."
This is the end of cassette number 1, ending on page 48. This story continues on cassette number 2, side 1.